listening to Wine on the Vine with Lisa Mayaka, only on LA Talk Radio.
Happy Thursday. Welcome to Thursday afternoon. If you're on the West Coast, if you're on the East Coast, welcome to Thursday evening. If you're listening abroad, as I have been notified, many are, welcome to whatever time zone you're in. Thank you for your time and attention, and you are welcome. I am Lisa Mayaka, your host for the next hour of what I call shameless storytelling. Shameless, not because we have no shame. Hello, we're human. I feel like we're full of shame at some level psychologically, but because I believe with all my heart there ought to be no shame, no blame in one's telling of one's story. If you will visit my website, the sponsor of this week's show, at www.wine.com, you will see Maya Angelou's quote, that there is no greater agony than an untold story within us. And so this platform, this show, the glory that is LA Talk Radio, is for that very purpose, to allow my guests to tell their stories, and you, my audience, whether you're driving in LA traffic right now, you're listening on audio, on online, or you're going to find us in the next week or months, or if you're live with us on Facebook, this is the forum and the format for us to connect one with the other in this glorious thing called storytelling. And so I've had a couple of stories told to me this week, and I just want to give shout outs before I bring my guest on. The Southern California is starting to open a little bit. We have ability to go sit outside and even inside in some restaurants. I met JT this week, who not only talked to me about cardstock and printing and wine, W-I-N-E, some of my favorite subjects, but we also talked storytelling, W-H-I-N-E, and he bought me breakfast in Upland at Molly Super. So JT, thank you for being one of the good ones and for contributing to this week's glory in the way that you did. And to Mike, who I met a couple of days ago and stood in an aisleway as the time just allowed, and he trusted enough to share some of his story. And you know, people, these are glorious opportunities to connect one with the other. And I am so grateful at this stage in my life, and honored, and I respect so much when y'all show up that way and you give your truth to me. I learn about you. I learn about humanity. From Mike, I learned about why Joe Rogan is the podcast that men listen to, and maybe what I ought to do on my show. These are just wonderful, wonderful moments. And so welcome. If you are following us on Facebook or Instagram, or you have looked at my blog this week, you will note aptly that my theme for the week is none less than holy hell, blessed chaos, and mystical mania, oxymoronic occurrences that we all ought to own. And if you look at the meme that I posted, you will see this very well-known quote, no pain, no gain, right? My gym coach says it every morning as I try to lift more weight than any girl ought to. But my presentation to you this week is not no and O. It is no, K-N-O-W, no pain, K-N-O-W, no gain. And there is one person on this planet that more than anyone else has helped me understand that that is the universe's resounding truth. And he is my guest today. And I don't know if I'll be able to keep myself contained or together. I am so honored to bring to you today's guest. He has served in my life in so many roles: pastor, professor, mentor, spiritual guide, confidant, and most recently and most wonderfully, friend. And it is far and few between that relationship that can kind of move through life's ebbs and flows over decades and maintain that kind of connectedness. So as my wonderful engineer brings him to the screen, let me read you his bio. Cornelius W. May Neal holds a Doctor of Ministry degree from Ashland Theological Seminary, has served as a senior pastor for over 40 years. Neal attended Kent State University in the turbulent 1960s. That's a story. Or 12. He earned a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree with a minor in education. As a seasoned minister, Dr. May has experienced the balance of both spirit and word, illumination and reason. He is founder and president of the Hosanna Bible Training Center, of which I was both participant and graduate. I don't know if he'll admit that, but I was. He was instructor of biblical interpretation, hermeneutics, Google that, it's in my blog, and contemporary preaching, homiletics. In addition, he continues to serve as an adjunct professor for Ashland Seminary, where he has taught small group ministry, communication and conflict in the church, because that's a thing, and archaeology of the New Testament. He's the author of many books. I own them all. I've read them all. I've slept on them all. Osmosis. I have studied them all. He even sends me his books in progress and says things like, "Lisa, would you help me edit this manuscript?" When I really know what he's saying is, "Lisa, you need to read this for your own well-being." So welcome.
Hello, Lisa. So good to see you. Hi.
How are you?
I am well. Thank you for the invitation to come out and be with you. So,
welcome to the West Coast.
Wonderful.
And so I don't even know where to begin with you, because I know the stories could keep us live on the air until 2023. I wonder, though, if we can start with storytelling itself. Mm-hmm. Because you taught me storytelling as the way in to an audience when my conclusion was something philosophical, theological, some truth.
Yeah, I think there's a difference of talking at people and talking with people. And the power of story is people connect with it. And I always say stories are as old as time. We begin with a creation story. So that's what we call it. But from there, you can go to Aesop's Fables, the Tales of Canterbury, all the way to Gilligan's Island. So we have these stories, and everything you read about my bio, there's a story in every single category and every single movement, every single day, every single year. So life is stories. It's a sequence of stories. And at the end, we call it the story of life. So our brain even processes it in story.
So I know you're like 12 times brilliant. And you have neurological understanding, you have astrophysical, mystical, theological, philosophical, artistical, and magical, maybe. I think one of my favorite quotes of all time comes from the late actor Alan Rickman, that said, "It is a human need to be told stories."
Yeah. Well, they said our brain tells us stories all night long while we sleep.
dreams.
Yeah. So it just tells us stories. So we are story, we live story, we buy into stories. I think the comical thing about Gilligan's Island, I'm assuming everybody knows the story, is that when they aired that program, people called our government and said, why can't we go rescue these people stuck on this island? So they could not separate story and reality. And when they study brain waves, MRIs, when people tell stories, the teller and the listener are exactly the same. So there's something about story that we buy into that, and it becomes our story as it's narrated to us and for us, and we travel with them.
So you're saying this study looked at what the brain was doing with the storyteller, him or her, right, herself, and yes, the listener, and the same activation was occurring.
Exactly, exactly. That's how far into the story. Well, you can see how important it is to get the right story from the right person telling the right things. So if people get the wrong story, well, then you get wrong ideas and wrong things. So a very powerful medium, you know, to use to connect with people.
Well, now I feel like I need to take notes because this is all new, this is all news to me. But when I was studying under you, Lo, these many years ago, like 2005 and 2006, and I sat in your homiletics class, which is the art of preaching or proclamation, you introduced to me these two avenues of conveying information. One was inductive and one was deductive.
Right, correct.
What's the difference?
Well, the deductive in our brain, we have part of our brain is what data-driven, and the other part of it is story-driven. So if we're only deductive, we're not connecting with people all the way. And if they don't respond, let's say in an emotional response, they didn't respond. Just because they got information doesn't mean it will be transformative and impact their life or change their life. Story has a way of doing that.
And is that true across the genders and sexes and all the evolutions of who we are as human beings?
Yeah, from what I know, yes, yes. And of course, there's always more research to do and read, but yes.
Always.
Power of story. Yeah, the power of story.
So for my audience, I sat under Neil's pastoral leadership for several years, before I came under his tutelage as a professor and then learned to preach myself. That didn't last long. But anyways, I have sat myself under his proclamation because I have found what else is out there wanting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's something very inviting about joining story with what you would consider truth.
Right.
How do you do that?
That was the model of Jesus, what we call them parables. So Jesus would always tell a story. Predominantly, he would tell stories. So I think the deductive model works with a group that you know. It's a smaller group. But when you have the masses, and like you said, there's gender differences, racial differences, age differences, all kind of differences, the story is able to loop us all together.
So what's your story?
I'll start somewhere with a story. We don't want to just teach on storytelling. Maybe let's tell a story.
Let's tell a story.
And I think if we look back over our life, it's a sequence of stories that really all relate. It's just when we get a chance to do that, Steve Jobs, the great entrepreneur from Apple, said, connect the dots. But he said, when we look at the dots in our life, if we all remember in school getting a picture with dots and we had to draw the lines, then you get an image. Well, he said, you can never look at the dots forward. You can only look at the dots backwards. And when you look backwards and see the dots, then you would see there is a major dot connector. I call him the divine designer, the dot maker above us. And when I connect the dots through my stories, a lot of them with pain, well, those are the ones that stand out, we remember. We see they're all connected, not coincidentally or just happenstance, but providence. So I'll tell you a story.
Will you tell me a story?
Sure. Sure. My pleasure.
Well, I think there's, before you do, and then I'm done, there is one theme that resounds between the two of us that might have kept us as closely connected as we've been, lo, these many years, and that is pain.
Yes.
And
universal.
Yeah, well, you say so. I've run from it in so many ways, in so many directions, in so many attempts to avoid, as have most humans. And yet you have continued to invite me to embrace,
right,
sit with, hold, acknowledge. And you have, I don't know, you've been through so much shit. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, that's apropos. Well, I'm living in Cleveland, so we have the great Cleveland.
There's
the greatest place in the nation, we call it. But I'm within the boundaries of the great Cleveland Clinic. So Cleveland Clinic, known around the world, number one, number two hospital in the world. And the clinic came out and made a comment that our brain processes physical pain and emotional pain in the same real estate of the brain. And the Cleveland Clinic said, we don't even know if the brain knows the difference between the two. That if you have physical pain, you will have emotional pain. And if you have emotional pain, you will have physical pain. So if we're going to look for wellness, which I always say is spelled with a we, so hence our friendship, it's always about wellness, that if we look at wellness, we need a we need community. But then we have to deal with both sides of that. And I think storytelling helps us dramatically when we look at the emotional side of us, because we buy into the stories of others and the grace and the healing that they've discovered on their journey.
You have held, though, such a public position as a pastor and group leader and author. How safe are you telling your stories? And where do you tell your stories?
I guess there's always a risk with it, and there's probably some stories I don't tell, but I may tell to a confidant, or I have a friend that's a priest and a therapist, so he becomes a great listener. So a lot of times when you tell a story, you're not looking for judgment. you're sharing with
time you're telling a story.
You're sharing because of the power of sharing. You're sharing to share. So we have to teach people how to listen and not to pass judgments to become. I think part of what I want to say today is becoming islands of grace. If we all can become islands of grace, that people can come to us. Because when I go through some of the journey of pain in my life, you're always looking. Some storms of life you can sail around. Some storms in life you can sail through. But often you can be shipwrecked, and then you're on and looking for an island, some safe place where there's safe people with safe place with safe promises. And I said, you never know who's going to wash up on your island. And so if we become that island of grace and people come to us with their stories, and then we share our story, and we can find that piece called wellness.
So now you're preaching.
No. Oh, that's for Sunday. That's for Sunday.
That's so good. I remember the invitation that you gave me very early on to share, or not to even share, just to find a safe place. And my safe place was very, there was no people. There was no people that could access that place. Because at the time that you invited me there, it was, guided imagery, whatever.
Right.
I felt no safety. So, you're on my broadcast today. We're airing in LA. We had 16,000 people listening first.
Wonderful.
The show, right. But, well, it's wonderful if that's what you're about. But
right.
Is there a story that you feel safe sharing with this kind of space?
Oh, sure. I share anything that can help another. And sometimes I think when we share what we've been through, we create a bridge for people to trust you.
Yeah.
Because then they say, oh, he understands.
Yeah.
If he understands, then they're going to tell you their story.
Mm-hmm.
So if I keep too high of a profile or too distant from my listening audience, they're not going to say anything. So you'll never know if they're depressed, discouraged, or in trouble, suicidal, you know. So the power of story.
Is there a story you want to tell?
Yeah, I'll start with one that can be a segue and then we can go from there. Mm-hmm. Very simple story. To get away from ministry, of course, I thought, well, I'm going to take a cruise. So I went down to Florida and we get on this big cruise ship called the Norway, and we're going to head out to do the islands. So when the cruise starts, it's like the Love Boat. So they take everybody the back of the boat. There's confetti, there's a band, they're playing calypso music, you know, free food, free drinks. And you're going, this is great. This is going to be a great cruise. So then you go out, you know, you learn to settle down. And every once in a while, the captain would make an announcement that if you look off this side or that side, you may see lightning off in the distance. And then he would say, we're going to be turning the ship. We're going to head this way because there's storms. They also tell you there's other ships with you. Usually two or three ships are sailing together ever since Titanic. Mm-hmm. So again, the strength that you can find in others with community. So he would do that all through the trip. So as we're coming back into port, I went to the back of the boat thinking, all right, free music, free food, free drink. And there's nobody there, not one person, no band, no music, no confetti, nothing. And you couldn't even find somebody to help you with your luggage. And I'm thinking, now this seems wrong to me.
Right, right.
Because I think we should be celebrating that you have successfully sailed the seas of life and have come back. And I think we do this at birth. We celebrate a baby's birthday and hallelujah for that. But we never know who they're going to be and what they're going to do and what they're going to become. And then at a funeral, we're hesitant to celebrate a life that has sailed the seas of life, and here they are. So you learn a lesson about storms at sea. And that's what I've learned. Because if we got caught in a storm, we're going to be looking for that island of where we can take residue. So you introduced me as being a graduate of Kent State University.
Yes.
So at those times, I said, if you remember the 60s, you probably weren't there.
But,
so I'm a 60s, 70s guy. I now tell people I survived the 60s twice. So here I am. In the 60s, though, the shootings at the school, and then they closed the school.
Well, you were present, right? You were.
Well, I'll tell the story. Yeah, I was in a rock and roll band, so here's my hair. But I had long-haired hippie. You know, us hippies were trying to get other people to join us to be nonconformists. Think about it. You know, we all the hippies dressed alike. So anyhow, when they closed the school, our record was doing well, and they said, well, why don't you go on tour? So they took us up into New England, and we were in Burlington, Vermont. So if anybody's listening from out that way, we are on WCFR, Ron Bastone. So we were doing a concert. They're pushing our record. And, you know, that was all well. That was all doing good. But then you hit a storm. But part of Kent State was, because when we were up on this radio station, he's interviewing us almost like what you would do with your guest before the show starts. And he's asking everybody in the group, where are you from? Yeah. And they said, Cleveland State University, this. And he asked me, I said, well, I'm from Kent State University. And he goes, oh my gosh, don't mention that on the air. You know, the students were just shot. I said, all right, whatever. So during the program, he must have forgot. So he's talking to us as band members, and he gets to me and he goes, well, where do you go to school? I said, Kent State University. And the switchboard lit up like a Christmas tree, man. People called, and that was, he looked at me like, why'd you say that? And I'm going, why'd you ask?
You asked me the question.
I was at Kent State. Of course, I commuted, so I drove in all the time. And I was there every single day except for the day the students were shot. Now, I'm a long-haired hippie. I was studying photography. I was a fine and professional art major. I probably played in every bar, tavern in Kent with our band that we were in. And on that day, when the students were shot, that May 4th, I got up to go to school. And my dad, who was kind of retiring out of his business, moving into part-time police work, grabbed my car keys and he said, "You're not going to school today. Somebody's going to get shot." So I think he saved my life from this terrible storm, because if you were there, everybody's in it. And I have all these photographs that I've taken all the way up until that moment, what happened there. So there's storms. When I come out of Kent, the storm, our record and all that just kind of crashed. So I ended up into marriage. I have a first child who is just lovely. I have a second child. And in the birth, there were some problems. So the doctor says to us, the placenta was problematic. Your child's here, he's breathing, blah, blah, blah. But I want to study the placenta. We said, fine. So they kept the child in the hospital. And then they kept my wife in the hospital. And a couple of days later, they said, all right, you can take him home. So we go to pick up our baby. You know, they got him in a blanket, our bundle of joy, bone of our bone, flesh of our flesh. And here's this nurse. She hands him to us. She's dressed in pure white, a little hat and white. She goes, "I've never been so glad to get rid of a baby in all of my life."
What's that even mean?
I don't know. If you said that today, there'd probably be a lawsuit, you know. But we said, give us our child. What is she talking about? What does she know? We get this child home. And shortly after that, we noticed he can't sleep. The only way he'd sleep would be on my chest. So if he was up, everybody in the house is up. So you learn to sleep when he sleeps. So we're seeing what's symptomatic of some kind of problem, but he was normal in every other way. But as that storm went on, and the storms can be just a wind in your face, they can be a storm and they can manifest into a full gale. And as he went on, he started to need special schools, special care, special medication. We started hearing words like bipolar, manic depressive. And he just couldn't function. He was so rich and just fast. Everything had to be quick. We had to be in a school where his classes were only 20 minutes. By the way, when I look back at school, my favorite class, and I have 4 degrees, was story time. Right? That's our favorite class.
Yes.
So finally, my son now is in oppositionally defiant. We're introduced into psych wards. And when I took him to the first psych ward, I'm walking down the hall with him. We have a doctor in front of us, my son, me behind him. And we come up to this padded room. The doctor opens the door and goes in. My son goes in and I go to walk in. And the doctor puts his hand on my chest and just lightly pushes me back. And he says, "You can go no further." And the door shuts almost on my nose, just this wind coming up to my face. And I thought, what just happened? Did I give my child to the state? And I didn't know what. I walked down the street. Now I'm educated. I got degrees. I'm a pastor. I've studied psychology. I walked down the street, got a hotel room, went in and laid down and cried for 2 days, because it's your child. It's bone of your bone, flesh of your flesh. So all of a sudden now we are living with a bipolar who has suicidal ideations, very manic, but we move him into his teenage years. And he's adjusting in a short school. They reward him. If you make a 20-minute class, you get a candy bar. But in the teenage years, I finally get another vacation into Florida. But I get this late night call that your two sons were in a car accident. And they said the one that was driving is fine. The other one, who is the bipolar, was in the back seat. And when the accident started to unfold, he looked around the driver, and the accident got hit by a drunk driver, over 12 DUIs, catapulted him into the dashboard of the car. So it ripped his face all in shreds. So he's in the ambulance. I'm in Florida. And my friends, my doctors called me and said, "You better get up here." So he lives, but then I have to take him to a plastic surgeon. So I'm sitting in the office of a plastic surgeon, looking at my son's face. We called it Frankensteinian. And I'm looking at everything in this office, but every book was straight. Every picture on the wall was hung perfectly. Every single item in this whole office was perfectly represented. And I'm thinking, I'm in safe hands. There's an island here of grace. So they do all these stitches. Then, Lisa, I find out, because my son is manic, he's able to survive all the stitches. It doesn't matter. He's still going forward, full speed ahead.
Catapults him to the next.
If this would have happened to somebody else, they would have been shriveled up in their home for the rest of their life. And I'm looking at this illness, disease, brought him this strength. So years later, he calls me one day, he goes, I signed up for the Army Reserves. And I'm thinking, he's never going to get in. We have this whole psychological profile,
right?
Yeah. And next thing you know, he's shipped overseas to Afghanistan and that, and he's a gunner and he's escorting people behind the lines. And one day he tells me that his commander comes up to him and said, the chances of us getting back alive are slim to none. We just thought you guys should know this. There's like eight of them sitting there. Well, they all look at my son, this bipolar, and go, hey, you're the pastor's kid. You need to pray for us.
It's all on you, kid.
And he prayed this prayer and they lived. So he comes back and he gets married and survives, but all this is manifesting. But he comes back with post-traumatic stress. Very difficult to deal with. And here again, a story that people need to tell, and yet where is it safe? Is there an island of grace for these vets to tell their story? And eventually the post-traumatic stress will get to him. But he is so, has a testimony, he has a story. And the Iron Workers of America, God bless these guys, they start a program called Helmets to Hard Hats to Helmets. So if you come out of, with post-traumatic stress, if you come out of that war zone, they'll help you with a job and give you a helmet in replace, give you a hard hat instead of the helmet. He does so well with them, and they're so impressed with his story. They said, listen, on 9/11, we're going to go up to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington Cemetery in Washington, D.C. We want you to represent us and lay the wreath on the tomb on 9/11. So he goes from this young boy where the nurse says, we don't know what to do with him. Now he's in Arlington Cemetery in Washington, D.C. because the iron workers were an island of grace and took him in. And we were just ahead of President Obama. He was waiting for us to finish, and then they would come in and do what they did. But eventually the post-traumatic stress gets him, and he will pass. He dies a couple years ago, just from a broken heart, just from the broken heart. And I could hide. It's a storm. No, I'm in a group no one wants to be a part of. Only those who have lost the child understand the grief of losing a child. You lose somebody older than you, it's like natural, we're moving that way. But when they're younger than you, it's like, I always say, grief is in the car with me every day. Yeah. Someday I can get it in the trunk. Someday it's in the back seat. Someday it wants to drive the car. It's just always there. So bearing a child is its unique thing. But I am grateful for all the people that took him in, like the iron workers. And I vowed with my life that I would always be that island of grace, because I never know who comes up on my shore. How they got their pain doesn't matter. What happened to them doesn't matter. Only that I can be a safe person, give them a safe place, give them safe promises like, we'll get through this. You overcome, hang in there and make it. So that's what I'm asking of your audience. Would we all become an island of grace? And when we become that island, we find that these are the dots that connect our whole life together. When we finally look back, and I believe the divine designer uses all those circumstances, all those stories to bring healing to one another.
So if you're listening by audio, I don't have Kleenexes here, so if I sniffle, pardon. If you're watching, you're clearly a part of what's transpiring here. What an honest, hard story to share. Thank you for your courage and trust. How, in the midst of whatever happened between your son's passing and today, did you decide that this story is worth telling. I have a quote from one of my favorite authors, Philip Yancey, from his book, What's So Amazing About Grace. And he, and I've written about this, but I'm still wrestling with it in my own self. Because I wake up morning after morning sometimes and I say, why? Like, why? Like, these things ought not to be.
Yeah.
Neil's son should not have died. This is not okay. Right. And there's so many things that catapult us into that thought process and, you know, exclamation. And what Philip Yancey submits to us is that there's a better question to ask if we're willing, and that's to lean into the universe and say something along the lines of, to what end?
Right. Yeah, I think the position I took, this can knock you down and out of the game if you're not careful. And then the great promise of St. Paul, take the comfort that you are given in your trial and take that comfort and give it to somebody else. So not always are we seeking to be comforted. We become the comforters. And when people find out that I've lost a child or I've had this happen or that happen, it's bridge building. Because I don't trust people.
What does that mean? What's bridge building look like?
I don't trust people who haven't had pain to understand my pain. They're just not there. So bridge building is when people understand certain levels of pain, you know, then like people say, oh, I had a headache. I said, well, have you ever had a migraine? Well, no. Well, then you don't know headache. You haven't had a headache.
You don't know headache. Like, I know headache.
Yeah, yeah. There's a different degree. So, but you can comfort people or be with them.
Right.
When you have those acknowledgments. So I said, it's important that we share our story of pain, because if we don't, well, then I have no bridges built to other people and I can live in my misery. But I'm grateful, like the Iron Workers of America, Dr. Richard Dobbins from Akron, the Emerge Ministries, the counselors and stuff that helped us. Those were all islands. And I want my life to be an island. So if your child would call me, or any child or anybody would call me, that either I can help them or get them to the right people with the right promises, with the right things. And that's how I use grace instead of judgment or anger and hurt. I use it as...
Okay, so grace to you is some, I mean, there's a definition, of course, but to you, it is this gift of experience and care that you can offer because you've been there.
Sure, that's the same thing that Jesus does for everybody in the Christian religion. It'd be the same thing, sure. St. Paul, the same way, yeah. Yep.
You weren't always a part of this Christian religion.
No, it's interesting. When I grew up Catholic, was trained in the Catholic schools and that, and then you kind of do your own search for spirituality. Mm-hmm. And when I was at Kent State, one of the Chicago Seven, the famed name at that time, came on the campus, Jerry Rubin, and did basically a sermon. He stood on a soapbox like an evangelist from the 50s or something. And his first message was, hate your parents. That Jesus taught you to hate your parents. And he was preaching revolution.
He was quoting.
Oh, yeah. Misquoting.
Not accurately.
Right, right. And I would say it was the first time I heard the Bible misquoted. It was right there at Kent State. So there's a lot of stuff when people hear about Kent State, they have these presuppositions. But you're hearing it from people that weren't there. And when you were there and you saw the story unfolding, you heard this chatter. And very radical, very, very radical. And as a hippie, that would probably be kind of the where you went and who you went with, you know.
So I've never been a hippie. I've always wanted to be. I think my hippie days are ahead of me. I'm really hoping. Like, I probably have to shed the makeup and, I don't know, do something else.
Just wear blue jeans, you're in.
I don't do that well either. But
okay.
What I... you and I have contended. We have not always been on the same mm-hmm. plane of conversation or belief. I mean, at all. And yet, I think it's this string of life experience and what you've done with your life experience that helps or forces or, I don't know, has you lean in
Yeah.
to another human experience, even one that you don't quite understand.
Yeah. As you know, I don't know if you held that book up. I wrote two books on pain. The first one is on called Chronic Ones, and it's living with pain, looking for hope. And it's people who haven't found an avenue of escape or wellness from pain, and how do you live with it? And then the second book I wrote is just coming out, is on that one. Yeah, chronic too, living with emotional pain, because we're seeing that they're very much simultaneous. And if you're going to have pain, you got to deal with one and the other, emotional and physical. So I ran a pain group for 7 years,
What does that
and
mean? You ran a pain group.
I wrote a 12-step program for pain. So how do you
I'm
process
Lisa and I'm a painaholic.
pain?
Wait, what?
Yeah, a pain in my neck, a pain in wherever, you know.
A
You
pain
may even work with one. Yeah.
in your neck?
But
And
people would come and again begin to share and find that it's safe to share in the right place and then to admit. And then try to guide them once you embrace pain, which is like what, number one, step number one. So I hurt. And when we can get there, you can start the journey of healing.
I think it's, well, Brené Brown is probably quoting from somebody else when she says that once the shame is spoken, it loses its power.
Right.
So I have experienced this once the pain, I mean, I think I'm in your book. I think I'm in one of these. I'm not
Yeah.
on myself, but I think I'm in one of these.
Yeah.
Once that experience is out, it loses the power of secretness and shame, and that gives it the power to transform. That gives us the power to
Yeah.
transform.
Yeah, no longer will control you either, where pain often has a way of controlling us. So our moods, our behaviors, our vocabulary, our verbiage, all that. Yeah. So I think my goal was to start more 12-step pain groups. And now people want to say, are you going to start another group for book two because of emotional pain? Where do you go to share emotional pain and trust someone where it not be disclosed?
Does that feel I don't know, it seems so ironic or ludicrous or wrong or some version of not okay to me. I just finished watching this lovely YouTube whatever, a gal who researched all things Denmark for a couple of years, and it's called Something About Living Danishly, but because they're ranked so high on happiness, but the piece that resounded for me was that when Danish people are suffering in their mental health, they take time off. And that's okay. They even get promotions while they're off because
Right.
the society embraces that as a fact of life, that
Yeah,
life.
model, sabbatical model, right? Yeah.
Say more about that.
Well, when we know of French Revolution, one of the things that they abolished in that was the Sunday Sabbath. They got rid of it. Well, what was it? After 1 or 2 years, they had to reestablish it, a Sunday Sabbath, not for religious reasons, but the health of the people had so deteriorated they couldn't do 7 days a week. They needed a day of rest. And I don't know if people get any days of rest, you know. So taken.
No, go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, day of rest could be quiet time. Doesn't mean stopping all things physical. It could be trying to stop all these
All
thoughts.
things in your head.
Yeah, you know, whatever.
I listened to your sermon Sunday, and the most, well, there were two pieces that one I'll keep to myself, the other I will talk about right now. You said the most powerful, no, the most important part of prayer is the first 15 minutes after we say amen.
Right. Yeah, that's probably not, like you said, not my quote. It's probably somewhere I've carried for 30 years, you know. But yeah, it's when we get quiet, we're in a prayer posture, which is listening. Most people probably think prayer is speaking, but I believe it's a listening posture. It's prayer is not about solution, it's about connection. And when you connect with, go back to Steve Jobs, he wanted you to connect the dots. And you have to trust the dots, whatever that may be. It may be religion, it may be karma to you, it may be something else to you. But somewhere you have to put your trust. For me, I'm going to say that's God. So I
Okay.
get quiet to hear what I believe the divine will speak to my soul.
Yes.
And I tell this, here's a story. This guy in a hospital, not doing well, bad heart. The doctors are very concerned. So the doctors come in to see him with all their assistants that they're training. The guy is laying in bed. The doctor thought he was sleeping, but he's just sitting there with his eyes closed. So the doctor listens to his heart and he turns to all the students and he goes, "His heart has a strong gallop," and they all leave. Well, this guy miraculously recovers. The next couple of weeks, they couldn't believe it. So he comes back in to see the doctor, and the doctor goes, "What happened? We thought you were gonna pass." He goes, "Doc, I didn't think I was doing well at all, but that one day you came in to see me, I was just listening with my eyes closed, and you said my heart had a strong gallop, and I knew I was gonna make it." Well, strong gallop in medical language means your heart is failing. You're probably not gonna make it. You're gonna
That's not what landed in his brain.
No. And I say, what you say to yourself is
Yeah.
far more important than what
Yeah.
anybody else says to you.
Yes.
So, like you said, cleaning up the self-talk, which is staggering amounts of words per day,
Yes.
and getting those where they're healthy will make us a healthy people.
And this storytelling that you have graced us with today is that very opening for some of us who aren't comfortable sharing these types of pieces of ourselves with anyone, not even our pillows.
Yeah.
And so I don't even know how to adequately thank you. This is why I need a podcast to everybody listening that's going to sponsor us going forward, because I need 2 more hours with Dr. May in order to unpack some of what's been offered here for you for you listeners. But I hope you are truly listening, because this is wisdom of the ancients coming through the voices of a few of us that are farther along in years than we'd like to be,
Yeah.
that have suffered tremendously and yet do not view that suffering as less than, but rather as some form of gift. And Neil, I don't even know. I always have the words. I always have words. They're not the right words, but I don't have the right words for you
Yeah.
today. Thank you so much for your vulnerability. Thank you for, I mean, there's so much the audience didn't hear today, but the man has endured church splits, family division, people like me that were supposed to be ministers, kind of going our own way and doing our own thing and not really measuring up.
Yeah.
The left foot of fellowship from denominations and misunderstandings from crowds and just so much shit.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
yet he still shows up in the humility and the bravery and the courage and with the stories that he shared with you today. So for those of you that can, please give him an ovation. You would say a clap offering.
Yeah. We always
Yeah.
reflect it up. Yeah. Well,
Well,
thank you for the invitation and lovely to see you. And
hope you'll come back
yeah, oh yeah, anytime,
to the
anytime.
West Coast. It's sunny out here.
Yes, yeah, it's great. Lots of stories to tell.
And thank you. And thank you to your dear wife, Jan, for helping facilitate all
We'll
the
do that.
technology. But bless you. And thank
Yeah.
you for being who you've been in my life, well
Well,
beyond.
you're an island now for so many listeners and callers, and you're that
I
island of grace. So thank you.
hope so. I hope Wine on the Vine becomes that for many, 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 many. So
Yeah.
blessings.
Blessings.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to Wine on the Vine with Lisa Mayaka, only on LA Talk Radio.